This is an oral interview with Rick Shepherd, head gardener at Redford Park Bowral. Rick will be speaking with me, Sue Whitehouse, for the Australian Garden History Society, as part of a collaboration with the Berrima District Museum to create an exhibition of 8 significant gardens of the Southern Highlands to be showcased with the Berrima District Museum Digital Gallery Story Centre. Rick, on behalf of the AGHS and the BDM, I would like to thank you for agreeing to participate in this interview.
My pleasure. I'm Rick Shepherd and this is my voice.
This interview is taking place today, Thursday, 3rd of October 2019, commencing at approximately 10:30. As you know, Rick, this interview is intended to cover the history, development and adaptation of the gardens at Redford Park, from commencement to the present period, in particular since your appointment by James Fairfax as head gardener in 2011, and including any future plans for the gardens at Redford Park now that you're working under the auspices of the National Trust. We'd first like to start with some biographical details. Where were you born?
I was born in Narrogin in Western Australia.
Do you have any siblings?
I've got three older sisters, Susan, Gay and Lisa.
And where did you attend school?
I went to Narrogin Primary School until year 5. And then I was year 6 and 7, they have 7 years at primary in Western Australia, at East Claremont Practical School. And then I went to, my high school was in Christchurch Grammar School in Claremont.
And who were your greatest influences in your early years?
Well, my mother was very good friends with Carol Cerventi. They were childhood friends. And her husband, Vin Cerventi, used to come to our farm quite often, and the two families were actually quite close. They were like cousins, the siblings. I still on regular contact with Kathy, their daughter. So Vin Cerventi was doing a book on the Dryandra Forest, which was adjoining our property, and I was really mesmerised with his love of nature and his knowledge of nature. And I think one of the things that really influenced me was to show that you could have a career in something that you really loved. And so he had a big influence on me as a boy and a young man.
Weren't you lucky?
Very lucky, yeah.
To have such an icon. So when do you think you were first introduced to gardening?
Dad used to grow veggies. I mean, he was a farmer, but we had a veggie garden. And yes. I was really interested in the veggie garden. Yeah, so that was probably when I was in a primary school age.
Yes.
And then in high school, I remember the veggie garden was outside my bedroom window, and when I was supposed to be studying, I'd be looking out at it and I'd find all these excuses to put down the books and go out and my sister used to call it a veggie garden extension program. So every time I had an assignment due or everything, the veggie garden would grow bigger. Yeah.
I know it well.
Yeah.
Any excuse.
Yeah,
but
any
that's
excuse.
A profitable excuse, isn't it? Because it's furthering your career, you could argue.
I suppose, yeah.
I like it. So your passion for gardening, obviously, at an early age, and you had good guidance, and perhaps your family indirectly were guiding you in that direction too.
Yeah, yeah.
So where did you study horticulture?
Well, I actually didn't study horticulture. I went to, the school I went to was very much training the students to go to university.
Yes.
And so there was no question that you wouldn't go to university. Mm. So I went to university in the University of Western Australia and studied science, and I majored in botany and zoology.
Mm.
And I worked for a while in the Department of Horticulture in Perth, in doing research, and I just found research wasn't really for me. It was a bit boring. I found it boring.
Yes, you're not out there watching it.
It was quite a lot of field work, but it was. Mm. I've got more creative drive, and so I found the research didn't really work for me.
It was regimented.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
What influenced your gardening style?
Okay.
Did you travel? Did you work amongst friends?
I did. Yes. So when I moved to the East Coast, when I was in my 20s, I got a job in a garden centre.
Yes.
And you know, I would have given up the horticulture employment in Perth, and I wasn't thinking of doing, you know, horticulture again. But then I got a job in a garden centre because it was easy.
You knew.
And that really started me into more ornamental horticulture. I hadn't really, didn't really have a lot of knowledge in that field because training in botany is not horticulture.
Biology.
And so that exposed me to a lot of plant material and different plant material that I was used to because the East Coast was a much different climate and soils. And the woman who ran the centre had a landscaping kind of arm. So I ended up working in the landscaping arm. And I just found I really loved that because that was creative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I could, you know, we'd go in, we'd almost do, backyard blitz. We'd start with a clean palette and then we'd just, you know, renovate and create. And I found that was when I really realised that this is what
you
I meant to be doing.
Talent for. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Very good. Moving to Retford Park, it has an incredible history, commencing from 1887. What do you know of that early history? Can you tell us the story you know?
Yeah, well, it was the Gundungurra people were here first. I always think they get overlooked.
Good, absolutely.
And they were here for, you know, many tens of thousands and looked after the land much better than I think we have done in the last 200. Then Edward Riley was here, and then Sam Horden bought it, and it was his country residence.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, the big house. I guess it was, you know, for status, you built a big house, and, you know, when you had the money, and he ran his studs here, and I guess what you did when you had that amount of money, you had your country property, and I guess you'd entertain your friends, and but very, very much I think it was about...
It was an agricultural venture, wasn't it?
But also I guess...
Status.
It was about status, I think. Mm. That was the primary thing.
Well, but the umbrella of the Hordens in the area was dramatic, wasn't it? But it was immense wealth.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that overrode everything, I think, because the department stores in those days were making
lots of money. And then the second Sam Horden, I think, from what I've heard, they were the ones that really got into the garden.
Sir
I think
Sam,
his wife was really...
Charlotte,
She really loved the garden. And apparently they used to have a veggie garden that they would supply to other places and, you know, that sort of thing. And down in the park, just down below where we're now, that used to have a veggie garden, apparently.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and then the third Sam Horden, I don't really know much about his influence.
I think that was short-lived, the third. But, yes, fascinating family history there. But it was that middle Samuel who, and his wife Charlotte, wasn't it?
And I did get to meet the fourth and the fifth Sam Hordens. They came here at an open garden and introduced themselves, which was lovely.
Fascinating.
In fact, I've still got the phone number of Sam the fifth, who's in his 30s.
Oh.
Yeah. And they loved coming here. They absolutely loved it. They were so happy to see that what their... family had created was being looked after, and they really were so happy to come here.
They'd be so proud of that.
They were so proud, and they were so happy to see that, you know, the original vision was still intact, and that the respect was shown, and the buildings were being looked after, and the garden was being looked after,
and all the history preserved still.
Yeah,
to
that was
that
lovely
layer.
To meet them.
Yeah,
I've got a photo actually.
Okay, and do you know if there how much is left here? Now, I know when we were here a week ago, a lot had just been packed up and shipped off to Sydney.
Of
the records of sort, any diaries or
catalogues. We have got a lot of that material. We have kept a lot of it because we're in the process of developing the conservation management plan. So there is a lot of documents, like receipts from... I know there's a receipt from a correspondence... regarding the importation of two abutilons, like from customs, these two abutilons that came from overseas. And so actually one of my projects I want to do is actually get two abutilons and have them at the front of the house, because there's no abutilons here, so I don't know what happened to them.
No.
But that's it was really good to read through those records and find out that, you know, James had gone to this effort to import these abutilons, whether it was driven by him or his gardener, I don't know, but he'd obviously sanctioned it and paid for it. And so, there was a lot of records here. We have kept them on site because we're still developing the conservation management plan. Mm. So Scott and I have read through a lot of those documents, yeah.
That'd be nice to link them to that somehow, to that early receipt, the ones yes. that you now yes. have. There's a story
yeah.
there.
There is,
which is
yeah.
lovely.
Yeah.
Gardening equipment, any old ploughs or...
No, like I know at Golden Vale, they've got that lovely old lawnmower, that horse-drawn lawnmower. We don't really have a lot of the original equipment, no.
No, okay.
I guess there's an old sort of turf lifting gadget there, it's a metal thing you use for sliding under turf, which
yes.
probably hasn't been used for many, many years.
Mm.
But no, not much in the way of mechanical equipment.
No.
Yeah, there's the big roller out there from the tennis court.
Okay.
Which is on display just opposite the office
right.
there.
As long as they're on display. I think they're all...
I found that in one of the sheds, actually, so I brought it out because I thought, this is a really interesting
item. It's got age on it.
Yeah.
Important as we age. Can you tell us about your experiences working in this garden? For example, what's a normal day?
Okay, a normal day. Do you want to do today?
This might be
today.
A little abnormal.
Yeah,
but,
so maybe we'll go
what
yesterday.
Would you be doing? Yeah,
so yesterday we had our volunteers come.
Yes, that would be
every
interesting.
Every Wednesday,
how
so that's great.
When
they usually come at 9, so between 7, they usually come around 7.
Yes.
Let the chooks out will be the first job.
Lovely.
Do a quick walk around before my staff arrive. Jordan was here yesterday. So I've got Jordan here 5 days and Jim 2.5. So I usually get here before them and have a quick walk around. And
these are your employed staff?
Yeah, employed in the garden.
Yes.
And I'll have a list probably I've done the day before of jobs we're planned to do that day, and I'll just, maybe tweak that, decide in order of what we're going to do with the lawns or whatever is the major project for the day. And I'll get Jordan and Jim, if he's here, started on those, and then about 10 to 9 I'll come back to the office and be here for the volunteers, unless I'm somewhere else in the garden and they have to ring me up, where are you? And so we've usually planned something for the volunteers, like they've usually got their own areas, but we might just have to give them some little bit of guidance there.
Sure.
Yeah, and then we'll have morning tea at 10 and we all stop and have a share.
And recoup on what direction you've wandered off in.
Yeah. And mainly that's the social thing, really. Everyone has a nice chat and have a cup of tea or coffee and something to eat. Often my wife has made a nice cake or something, so we share that. And sometimes the volunteers bring in something, which is lovely. And then volunteers will be here till about 12 or 1, depending on how long they want to stay.
And the weather or whatever.
Yeah, that's right, In the afternoon yesterday, what did we do? Just, the different tasks. Oh, yeah, yesterday we had a meeting with volunteers. That's right. It was a planning meeting with looking at the direction of Retford Park, which was great. And I made a little presentation about my vision for the garden, and people were voicing their various ideas. One of the great ones was a cafe-style more food when we have open gardens, which I'm looking forward to.
I was going to come to that.
Okay,
so how do you prepare for an open day?
Okay, so... It's pretty easy these days. We've got it pretty well down pat. Because we're open so often, we don't stress as much. I was working for James Fairfax, we'd have an open garden once a year. So we'd have weeks of working towards it. But now it's more ordinary. So we've possibly lowered the bar a little bit because we can't put that amount of effort in every month. To make it every edge done, every hedge done, every lawn done. So we've got to accept that the public have to see that this is an ongoing process and it's not going to look perfect.
Yes.
But we do, at the same time, try and make it look perfect.
Mm.
So it's a matter of the week before an open garden is making sure that all the lawns are done, all the paths are tidy. The main area near the house is weeded and, looks good. And then we'll do things like arrange pots, whatever pots are looking the best at the front of the house or in various places like the front of the gallery, make sure the toilets are clean and there's flowers and that sort of thing. So, make sure the car park's mowed, make sure the entrance looks good at the front gate, that's all tidy, just check all the signs and that sort of thing. And then there's a lot of like signage and stuff we need to put up, like careful of the gravel or no entry, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Barriers, areas which are where we're trying to keep people out of.
To cover yourselves.
Yeah, and shutting different gates, making sure that the emu gate is locked so no one lets it out. All little things like that. Yeah, so it's like we've got a checklist of things we do, but we've got it, you know, it only takes about an hour and a half these days to do those final kind of...
So that's been perfected, but it's been adapted from the James Fairfax days.
Yeah, we used to spend more time, like we used to, in the car park, we used to mark out exactly where to park, but, you know, we don't go to as much... didn't spend as much time these
days. So cause open days have become a lot more
bit more relaxed. Yeah, a bit more routine.
Have to be.
Yeah.
Okay, and I think we've talked about how important, I guess, the liaison with the volunteers will continue to become.
Absolutely, I said this yesterday. My vision is to make the garden even better and to make it the best garden in the country. That's what I really would like to see. And so the only way we're going to achieve that is having more visitors, more funding and more volunteers to really lift the presentation of
which
the
develops the awareness.
Yeah.
It automatically becomes more known and aim for the moon. You're up there with the stars.
Why not? Yeah.
So which is your favorite, getting back to you, which is your favorite area of the garden?
Okay,
and
I think
why?
The green room is one of the areas which I think is really special.
Yes.
It's hedged garden room that David Wilkinson designed. It used to be all chook yards and apparently really kind of, you know, a hodgepodge of fences and, you know, old sheds and stuff. So James Fairfax purchased this sculpture called Euphoric Angels by Inga King. Mm. And so David Wilkinson was given the task of positioning or placing the sculpture in the garden. So he designed the green room with the sculpture in the middle, and then it's got a plinth of teuchrum and buxus, and then the four hedges around it and grass in between. And I think it's a really special place. It's very minimalist, like there's no flowers, there's no distractions, there's no pots, there's no busyness,
just
the sculpture.
Yes.
Yeah, and I always say when I take a tour that when it was put there, this was a private home, and I don't know if there's many other artworks in a private home in Australia that would take up that much space, you know, which was a real indication of how much James Fairfax really loved art.
And believed in that. Mm. Wow. And have you given specific areas of the garden that you've named yourself?
Yes. So the fountain walk, which is at the front of the house, I've reworked that quite a lot. So that was originally designed by John Codrington in the 1960s.
Mm.
And when I came here, it was similar to what it is now, but I've really reworked it, added a lot more. There was a grey garden there, so I've added more grey plants and I've clipped them in the hamburger shape, which I call Blob. So I've renamed that garden the Blobbery, which is a bit less formal than the fountain walk.
But says it all.
Says it all. And visitors seem to resonate. You know, seems to resonate with that name. They enjoy it.
Well, you particularly resonate when you go up in the house to the high point to get that classic photo of the Blobbery.
Yes, it becomes quite iconic.
Remarkable.
Yeah. So I tried, I guess, injecting humour into the garden is something that I really like. I think
absolutely
formal older style gardens can be quite stuffy.
Mm.
So that was, I guess, one of my signature sort of styles is to have a little bit of whimsy or humour and
Which makes it a happy garden.
The tap sculpture over on this outside where we're sitting is another example of that. I call that the waterless garden. So we took out a hedge which was there and replaced it with drought-tolerant plantings and these taps which we found in the shed. And the little thing I say is like, when you've got a waterless garden, what do you do with the taps? So we made a sculpture out of them. So I think it's... It just gets people thinking.
It is whimsical.
Yeah, and it's whimsical.
Lovely touch.
Yeah.
Other gardens
that I've named, Auntie Eileen's best room, which is just near where we're sitting now, which is a garden room which I constructed since I started working for James Fairfax. So that is based...
The one with the chairs that are there.
Yeah, the living couch.
I love it.
So that is named after my great aunt, who was Eileen Coucher. And she was a farmer's wife in Western Australia. And everyone said, oh, she was crabby and she was this, that. And I thought, but then I heard that she was highly intelligent. And, you know, my aunt said, oh, she should have been an academic. And I thought, well, that maybe that's why she was crabby, because she was frustrated and she was, her opportunities were limited as a farmer's wife. And so, yeah, that's why I did that room, was to sort of say what that was her sort of sacred space within the house, and that was where she could have complete control over one room. So it's a room with like a living room with a couch and a rug and a lamp and a window and curtains, and it's like the best room in the front of the house that she could, you know, have her sanctuary. Yeah,
and at least be in control of and make her decisions.
Exactly. Yeah,
yeah. Well, I think that's a lovely remembrance. It's
Other gardens that I've named, oh yeah, the Cretaceous garden.
Okay.
So that's the bunya pine, which is just near the front of the house, which is probably the most iconic tree on the property. So when I first came, that had lawn underneath it, and so we got rid of the lawn and just let all the lovely bunya mulch develop. Do you want me to stop it and we put it out?
Good again.
So yeah, the Cretaceous garden. So we took out the lawn, and then I let all the bunya leaves, which are quite spiky, form a mulch, which I thought was quite beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then it's an idea I have had since I studied botany years ago, is creating a Cretaceous garden where you, because I studied paleontology or paleobotany, I suppose it was. So you're looking back 100 million years when Australia was part of the Gondwana continent, mm-hmm. supercontinent. And virtually there were no flowering plants back then. They hadn't evolved, or they just started to evolve. So Australia would have been dominated by big Araucaria forests, things like the bunya, and the understory would have been cycads and ferns and other non-flowering plants, ones that evolved before the flowering plants. So I pitched it to James Fairfax again to do a Cretaceous garden and to put a sculpture in there based on that era, and he agreed. So we took out the rest of the lawn, planted cycads, two types of cycads and about five types of ferns or natives. And then we put a sculpture, which is called the Muttabarosaurus nest. So it's eggs from an extinct dinosaur that was a herbivorous dinosaur that did live in Australia in Araucaria forests, possibly in this area, we're not sure. But yeah, again, it's a bit of fun.
Oh, it's a fabulous
dinosaur
link,
eggs. Yeah,
and I hadn't realised the history behind that, but it's amazing.
Yeah. So it's, I'm trying to get people to imagine the Earth in another era. Yeah, and this is possibly what it looked like. Yeah.
The layers, which is what you're definitely paying service to. I love that. Okay, moving on to your passion for sustainable gardening.
Okay, so when I first started here, it was a contract with James Fairfax that I was involved with, a garden maintenance contract. And I, in my bid, had to do like a tender, I suppose it was, a tender document to pitch for the contract. I said that I wanted to run things sustainably because my business was called Sustainable Gardens. That was based on looking after the garden in a way that's good for the environment. So that was focusing on things like not using chemicals, improving the soil health, improving things like biodiversity, and recycling and reusing, and one of the things that impresses me is the doctor's oath, which is do no harm. And I think gardeners should do that too. We should do no harm. So we shouldn't be using things like toxic chemicals, and we shouldn't be doing things that are going to, you know, kill the earthworms or harm the birds or even harm ourselves.
Yeah.
So James agreed to that proposal. So when I first came here, like, the shed was just full of chemicals. There was like, a truckload full, and full of, you know, fertilizers, you know, chemical fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, excuse me, fungicides, miticides, you know, growth retardants, you know, the whole lot. And they just never got used, and eventually a lot of them went to the recycling, and somehow they I don't know what they do with them. And so we started doing things like, and there was not even a compost heap here. All the garden refuse used to get burnt. It was just a giant pile. So that was one of the first things I did. We started separating waste. So we had a chipping pile, which would get the tree loppers to chip. Then we'd have a compost pile and for the smaller items that were compostable. And then we'd have another pile, which was things we didn't want to go into the compost, like maybe onion grass bulbs, and they would go to the chooks. And so everything had a use.
Yes.
Yeah, and then we started doing things like some things were too big to chip. So we made the giant benches that are down by the canal and the bicycle rack here and the trough, the succulent trough outside the stables. So it's a matter of, you've got to sort of look at each item of waste and say, this is an asset rather than waste.
Mm. And can it have an alternative?
Yeah, can it have an alternative? And now we make compost and we've got our neighbour who gives us cow manure, horse manure rather, and we go to a couple of cafes in town and we get coffee grinds, and then we put our lawn clippings there and our soft prunings, which we chop up with the lawnmower. And yeah, we've fertilised all our lawns with compost this year, and it's been a fantastic result. Yeah, and we've done a lot of things to improve the biodiversity here. So it starts from the ground up. So we're using a lot of mulch and a lot of diversity of mulch. You'll notice there's often sticks and branches under the trees, not just leaves. So that gives different habitat opportunities for different organisms. And then the birds come. It's the full circle.
You've noticed a change.
Yeah, we've got 78 species of birds we've recorded here over the last few years.
Fantastic.
And other things too, like put in things like safe watering for birds, like a bird bath. We put in a few nesting boxes. We've planted some natives in a windbreak next to the orchard to try and bring in more honey eaters, because there's not many honey eaters here. Yeah.
That's rewarding.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we've already addressed the change in approach that has come about with the National Trust now in control of the property. will you, on what way will you liaise with them and adapt to their auspices or stewardship, I suppose?
Yeah, so we're about to
develop a
document called the Conservation Management Plan, and that will also have another layer underneath the Garden Management Plan. And what I'm trying to inject into that is there's a couple of things that I think need to be put into that, and one of them is climate change. So we need to know that the garden, okay, in 2019, it's like it is now, but in 10, 20, 30 years' time, the climate will be different. It's already changed the last 8 years I've been here. And so when a tree dies, say, we've got to work out why it died. Did it die because it was too old or had a disease, or did it die because of the changing climate? And so I want the document to be flexible enough so that we could say, well, we'll try and keep the character of the garden the same, but we don't have to stick to the species that were here in 2019. Mm-hmm. Everyone says the Southern Highlands is a cool climate garden area, but I think we have to acknowledge that it's really on the cusp of a cool climate garden, and it's going to be changing in the future. So that's an important part. I think climate change needs to be
heavily built
into that document. Another thing is that over the last 50 years, there's been a lot of enormous amount of change in the garden. John Codrington, redesigned the Fountain Walk, or now also known as the Blobbery.
Yeah.
David Wilkinson designed the Green Room and the Knot Garden and the Persian Carpet and the Millennium Canal. Guildford Bell built the swimming pool. So there's been a lot of change over the last 50 years. So for the garden to reflect James Fairfax's era here, which the National Trust want to do because he's the one that very generously gifted it to the National Trust, I think the document has to acknowledge that change is part of the culture here, and so change should be continuing to be part of the garden style here.
Absolutely.
And we shouldn't be locked into a 2019 garden or 2017 garden. We should acknowledge that you know, every 5, 10, 15 years or something, there's an opportunity to do something different.
Sure.
And that needs to be part of that document.
Important. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, I think that's just about wraps it up. Obviously, it's in good hands. Absolutely fascinating to hear, particularly that last point that it is going to continue to change and evolve.
Well, these are just my thoughts, but I'm hoping to put them in the document. But that'll be my pitch.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Absolutely fascinating.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Just something that we did cover yesterday was that we do have the orchard and the vegetable garden here, which were here at James Fairfax's time. But one of my visions is to see that expanded and incorporated into somehow using it for members of the public. When they come here, they can eat produce from the garden. And we did talk about that at yesterday's meeting, and I think, you know, there seemed a lot of enthusiasm for that.
That is linking back to the heritage, isn't it?
That's
so
right.
So that's an aspect that...
Yeah, because the Hordens had the veggie garden.
Absolutely,
yeah, so
and
it
that's
does,
when it started to evolve, so that you're taking it...
Yeah, almost full circle.
Acknowledging, if you like, or...
Yeah, and we do, whenever we do, any sort of minor decision in the garden or major decision, we always try and link it back to James Fairfax. And even in the events we run, we try to... Like, I'm thinking of doing a peony workshop because James Fairfax planted the peonies here, and that was something he loved. So,
very important. You're certainly acknowledging the heritage that's here as well as taking it in a new direction. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Sue and Rick, thank you very much on behalf of the Australian Garden History Society for doing this interview.
Yeah, so this is the Cretaceous Garden with the beautiful big bunya that everybody comments on this when they come here. And we've got all the cycads and the ferns and the lovely mulch from the prickly bunya leaves. And then we've got the Muttaburrasaurus nest, which was done... So it was I call it a collaborative artwork. So it was done myself, I designed it, and then Heidi McGeoch and Sam Larwell, who are based in Barrel, they built it. So Heidi made the ceramic eggs and Sam did the metal nest. So just next to the Cretaceous Garden are two blue chairs, and James Fairfax's letterhead had this symbol, which is on my shirt, which is the house with the showing of the bunya tree and a dog. And is that on, is it? We're just checking if it's on.
Yes.
And so when I wanted to repaint the chairs in the garden, I've chose the same colour that's on, was on his letterhead, and we've since had it put onto our work shirts. So a bit of, it's sort of corporate branding in a way, but I wanted to have like the same theme running through, because these chairs were white and the landscape architect David, he said, "Oh, white, you can't have white furniture in the garden. It's too attracts too, you know, eyes drawn to it too heavily. You want a darker color." So he suggested dark green. I thought, "Oh, dark green. I don't know. That's a little bit, to me, it was just boring." So we went for the blue, and we checked with James. Was he happy with it? And then the architect was happy, so we've gone for this blue. Yeah, and everyone seems to like it. Yeah, and I actually have seen it in other gardens too. It does seem a popular sort
it
of
is.
Color.
It's lovely.
Yeah,
it's a life to it, isn't
it?
Do you
nice.
Know what color blue it is?
I have got it, the colour sheet in the office there, but I can't tell you off the top of my head. Yeah. What I try and do is create a look as though somebody lives here, like James Fairfax is still here. So I try to make the garden not look like an institution, to make it look like this is someone's home, which it used to be. So that's why, you know, the pots at the front, we change, because when you've got your own garden, you change it. And that's why I moved some of the furniture around, because that's what you do at home, you change things. It's not static.
Yes.
So we're just at the front of the house here with the succulent collection. And one of the things I really like about this collection is A, that it's very appropriate for this site. It's very hot. They're drought tolerant, and then there's full sun here. The other thing is, okay, we've got a mansion valued at $20 million or something, but these succulents cost practically nothing. They all came from friends of gardens, and the pots cost practically nothing. They're just terracotta. Some of them I found on the side of the road. So I like the sort of the contrast between this place, which represents a lot of wealth,
but we've got a part of the garden which costs virtually nothing, and it's, anyone can do this at home. So yeah, that's kind of nice, and so it makes the makes this part of the garden what I call it being accessible. This is something that anyone can do. You don't need to be a millionaire to do this. So we're just walking through the garden, and Jordan's mowing, and there's that beautiful smell of freshly mowed grass. And I was just saying that one of the things I really love about summer is after a hot day and people got their sprinklers on, and the smell you get when you go for a walk in the evening of the hot, hard surfaces with the sprinkler, and I don't know, it just releases something into the air, and it's a very, very familiar and comforting smell.
That's the one thing with gardens, isn't it? It's about...
So we're just walking now through what I call the winter walk. This is another part of the garden, Sue, that I'm sorry, I have, didn't mention, but I have given my name to a name to it, so the winter walk.
The winter
so
walk.
So this pathway has always been here, but we widened it about 4 years ago, and it already had a lot of winter interest planting, like this Daphne that we're standing next to, and the Corollis at the other end. So I've planted more winter interest plants, and coincidentally, a lot of them are very fragrant. So you've got the Daphne, you've got the Lanicera fragrantissima, the winter honeysuckle. You've got, what else is fragrant? Anyway, quite a lot of fragrant plants, but also plants that just look fantastic in the winter. Yeah, Banksy rose is about to come out. Yeah, the hellebores,
yes.
And we've got the little snowflakes. So this is, and the cornice, the red stemmed cornice. So when in the winter time, I wanted an area that's particularly interesting in the winter, and the twisted filbert just there, that the hazel, which looks fantastic in the winter when everything else is bare. Yeah. So we're just walking around the garden, and we're in front of the deer sculpture, or the stag. So this was part of James Fairfax's collection that he had in Dorset when he had his property over there, the Mill House, I think it was called. And when that was sold off and a lot of the interior was packed up, and this sculpture arrived in a container along with the owl, which is on the other side of the garden. And so I was given the job of locating it in the garden, and James wanted to be able to see it from the veranda. So we've put it here, just below the house, and I wanted to have the effect that it was coming out of the forest and just sort of peering to make sure it was safe before it came out to graze on the lawn. And yeah, I think it's been quite effective to put here. Yeah, so apparently originally it was made in New York, and then it went to the UK, and now it's come to Australia. So it's a very well-traveled
deer.
So we're just walking into the bamboo garden now. And this garden, when I came to Retford Park, was really overgrown. It was very solid bamboo. And we spent a lot of time opening it up and clearing it out. And then we found the remnants of an old path. So we re-established the path. And then we cleared the centre of it, because I like the idea of standing in the centre and being able to look up to see the sky, which you can do. And then I thought, really, it needs some sort of sculpture or artwork in the middle here. So I found this artwork, which is called The Conversation, which is ceramic in the local studio, and we brought it here, and I on approval, I suppose it was. So and I said to James, what do you think? And he said yes, and then we went through the process of acquiring it. So yeah, so this I think it looks fabulous in this space, because it's very tall, three-part sculpture which mirrors the tallness of the bamboo. So we're just under the cork oak here in the park, Quercus suba, from mainly Portugal. It says Mediterranean on the sign, but I think it's Portugal and Spain. And what I've done here, again, this is my sense of humour. So instead of putting mulch of leaves or chippings, I put a mulch of corks. So they, some people unfortunately don't understand where cork comes from, and they think it's the fruit that's dropped. Oh, is that where corks come from? They just fall from the tree. So we've got probably 1,000 corks here, and my son's girlfriend, she works in hospitality, so she every month she brings me a little bag of corks. And yeah, we're just trying to make the garden a bit more fun, I suppose, and you know, create a bit of a talking point. Yeah.